Now entering Nerdist.com.
Let me ask you a question. Are you getting enough? I bet you'd love more, right? Well, AdamandEve.com wants to give you more with 10 free gifts. First, you'll get a little sexy surprise for you. Second, a specially selected toy for your friend. And third, a little something we know everybody will enjoy. Plus, you'll get 6 full-length DVDs. Adult style, you know what I'm saying. Number 10, the 10th gift, is free shipping on your entire order. Gotta love that. So what do you have to do to get your 10 free gifts? It's not hard. Yet. Just go to AdamandEve.com and select any one item. It could be an adventurous new toy, sexy piece of lingerie, or anything you desire. Just enter offer code SEXNERD at checkout, and you'll get the 10 free gifts. Go check out AdamandEve.com today. Select one item, and you'll get 10 things, including free shipping. When you enter offer code SEXNERD, that's SEXNERD, at AdamandEve.com.
Welcome to the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast.
Whoa, what are these kids doing in here? Hey, if you're under 18, go ask your mom. Now that we're alone, let's start the show.
Hey you, it's Sandra. And this episode, right before we started recording, Perry, my guest pointed out that my voice changed for when I started recording with him. Like, I was talking in regular Sandra talk, and then suddenly I was like, ooh, smooth jazz on the radio. And I don't want to be that person who does that, but I don't know how not to, because my regular speaking voice just kind of just gets up here, and I don't know. This is me talking. So even hearing myself now, I'm like, oh, smooth jazz. Anyway, a few dates before we start. January 18th, I will be teaching at the Sexual Health Expo in Los Angeles. Go to sexualhealthexpo.com for more info. I will be teaching a BJ class. Boom. San Francisco, guess what? I will be recording my first live right in front of you podcasts, January 29th and 30th, with San Francisco Sketchfest comedy, y'all. Go to sfsketchfest.com if you want to come out for that. Please do. It will be hot and hilarious. Right before Valentine's Day in LA with Los Angeles Sex Ed Academy. Those are my dates. Better believe it. And now onward to the interview conversation. So Perry Estupiña is, we'll get into it. We'll get into it with this interview. I did want to say, I feel weird saying this, but he's basically the Spanish-speaking world's Mary Roach. And if you know who Mary Roach is, she is a marvelous, intelligent, hilarious writer who combines science and her own adventurous spirit with a very conversational and easy-to-read reading style. I feel like I'm totally underselling her. She's great. And so is Pere. Except I don't read Spanish. Woo. But luckily he can speak English. So, and has a great accent. It was a lot of fun talking with him. We did get into a little controversy around the analysis of female ejaculation fluid. What do you think? What science have you found on this analysis? I've found so much different information from different places that I'm kind of burnt out a little bit, but what he brought to the table was great. You know, it's interesting. And he threw down some great stuff about the nerve pathways that innervate, that give us sensation and erogenous, delicious feelings in different parts of our genitals. He mentions a third nerve pathway I didn't even know about. That's right. I learned something majorly new and gives new implications for how to pleasure male bodies. What? Now, around minute 48 of the main body of this interview, I asked him about, I don't even remember what I asked him about, but he starts talking about this idea of population diversity and how extremely important it is for the survival of the species. And it lit me up inside in a way that marvelous, wonderful, like TED Talks. You know how TED Talks just make your brain like fire in great ways? Yeah, that minute 48 rocks my world. And then we ended with some more controversy around A point I wanted to explore further that Corey Silverberg made on the Sex Spotlight with Corey Silverberg episode around sex science. This is a juicy episode. I mean, we even role play flirting techniques in if you're ever in Colombia. Good times. I appreciate you. I do. Thank you for listening, and let's get to it.
The thing is that they didn't know that you were already recording.
Oh, okay. I was only recording for a second.
You're recording now?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I edit. Okay, I edit. So things like me telling you about technology, like, I just cut that out. And yeah, do you have any boundaries around what you want to talk about?
No, we can talk about everything, of course.
Everything. Cool. And of course, there's another thing. Is there anything I wanted to talk to you about your book? How do I say the title? Is it S equals EX squared?
Exactly. When I thought about a title that that connects science and sexuality, I thought, why not a formula? And why not? The most famous formula is EMC squared of Einstein, relativity, no? I said, why don't I write sex like EMC squared, S equal EX squared? For me, it was very cool. For many people don't understand that.
No, it's. I just want to make sure that I say it correctly because it's important.
I normally say sex squared.
Oh, okay.
Not all the things.
Oh, all right. Sex squared. I like it.
Like it's super sex.
Super sex. Exponential sex. Ooh, that's hot. Ah, okay, so this is usually my first question. Huh. How do I say your name? Okay, can we guess? Is it Pere Estupiña?
Ostras, you do it very well.
Yeah.
Pere, have you been practicing?
No, I just remember I love Pere, like from when you were on the show before. But then, so is it just Pere?
Pere,
Pere.
Yes. Pere.
Okay.
Pere is like Peter, but in Catalan. In Spanish, it's Pedro. Probably some people have heard about Pedro. In Barcelona, we speak Catalan, and Pedro is Pere. Like Pierre in France, or...
And is Catalan a dialect of Spanish,
no,
or is it a totally
it's not.
Other thing?
Many people ask me this. No, Catalan is a language. Like Italian is a language, it's a Latin language, Portuguese is a Latin language, French is a Latin language, Catalan is a Latin language. It's so different from Spanish than Italian, let's say. Someone who lives in Spain and doesn't understand Catalan.
So is Italian closer to Spanish than Catalan?
In fact, Catalan and Italian are closer than to Spanish. So Catalan would be somehow in the middle.
So are you trilingual?
No, I understand Latin languages because it's very easy to understand French or Italian, but I don't speak them fluently. So I would say trilingual in the sense that I speak English.
Wait, English, Catalan, and Spanish?
Yes.
That's trilingual, my friend.
I am trilingual then.
Yeah, just show it off.
Look, the language.
He just pointed at his face. okay, so, Pere, I'm really excited to have you here. You were on the second part of the Struggling with Monogamy episode. And it was funny because we were talking about struggling with monogamy, and then because I had just met you that day at whatever conference we were at, and I'm like, you're great. Come to this show. I'd like to figure out how to get you on stage. And then you came up and started talking about sex research. And like toothbrushes for rats.
I was very shy in that moment, in fact, because there were these three ladies there in the stage, three or four, I don't remember, Tuana, you, and someone else. Like, am I supposed, with this feminist touch, am I supposed to go there and explain something about female sex, start by talking about rats? It's like, I don't see if they will like that.
Oh, so you thought that we needed you to be a feminist or like do something? I guess it was pretty intimidating to have a bunch of women up there.
Yes, very attractive women also.
Yeah, we're pretty good. Lots of boots. Okay, so you talked about the rat clitoral stimulation through toothbrushes and all that, but you have an entire book called Sex Squared.
Yes,
which is not in English yet.
But it will be.
Oh, okay. Because I noticed that the first chapter at your website, pereestupina.com, I can read the first chapter, a part of it, in English. And I was excited that I could at least do that.
Ah, cool.
Oh, you didn't know that.
Sometimes the publishing house do something in my website that I can't control. So the first chapter is there.
It's not like all of it completely. I could tell that it jumped around a little bit. But no, it's there. See, read the first chapter.
Ah, yes.
And then it pops up, cool. And then it's...
Ah, yes, some parts of the book. Yeah, I think it's not the first chapter, but some samples.
Yeah. Well, it says read the first chapter, so if it's not, they should probably change that.
Yeah.
Oh, your face, you're just like, oh, well. Hilarious. So anyway, I was checking that out. Okay, so you have a very fancy, impressive bio on your website. You have a chemistry and biochemistry background.
Yes.
You call yourself a science communicator, and I'm familiar with that, like a science communicator. It's like you're trying to take the scientific community and all their finding and communicate it to the rest of the world so everyone knows about science. Is that...
Yes, there are two things. I mean, science communication in the broad sense is... It includes journalism in the sense, hey, there are things that are happening in politics, that are happening in science, and happening in the arts, and some journalists explain them to the public. Then there is also this educational side, no? Mm-hmm. Or magazines that people who are interested in science and want to know about something that's not really news, but how the universe started, or what's a black hole, or how we are able to play with our genome, and what's synthetic biology, or how the brain works, and all these neurotransmitters, and the brain project connecting the different areas. So people who are interested in understanding how the world works, we are writing books, writing stories, or doing TV programs, or it's more science communication, not necessarily related to the news. Or people who want to understand how our body functions during sexuality, during sex. That it's what I've been writing a lot lately.
Right, and what you were just telling me, I was like, we need to start recording, because we were over at my bookcase talking about sex books, is... when we were talking a little bit about Mary Roach's book, The Bonk, and a few others, Mating in Captivity, and how your book is thick and big and just full of juicy science info. And according to your website, and I must agree with this, is that you are transparent and delightful and wonderful, and your writing style just really pulls people in.
No, because you have to. If you write about science, you have to be fun, you have to be fast, you have to create stories, because if it's not, people don't want to write science. So I've been writing about sex and science from the same style. So people like it a lot. And I've been part of the experiments, and I exposed myself to some aspects of sexual behavior. So there is this fun anecdote. There's all the science that I've learned, or that I've read, and all the scientists I've interviewed, but also the funny stories about...
Like, for instance... So we were talking over the bookcase, and you mentioned that like, you're just a regular guy. You said heterosexual, just a dude, and you've been writing about science for so long, and then suddenly... You decide to write a book about sex.
Yes.
And the question that you've been asked a lot is, how has this affected your own life? Huh. Are you super kinky, wild?
I'm kinkier now, definitely.
Really? So,
of course.
Juicy.
Of course. No, because before writing this book, well, it was, again, very conventional, heterosexual, with my girlfriends or something. And one of the things that I've learned is that things that I thought that were weird, they are not so weird. They are very common. And in fact, when you do them, it's like, now I understand why people do this. So not to the extremes. If you talk about BDSM, for example, dominance and submission, I thought that was very strange. Oh, now I'm very vanilla, of course. But I see that it's fun. It excites you, no? It helps you to do something different, to be spicy, or tantra, for example. When I thought about tantra, tantric sex, all these chakra and energies, it sounded like very esoteric for me as a scientist, right. No? Then I've been in workshops and I've been driving myself to have orgasms without ejaculation, and I thought, it happens.
Oh!
It happens. So I thought, it was not... It was so esoteric. It's still esoteric, but it has an effect, no? So I would say that my sex life is wider now, no? Yeah. And a bit kinkier, yes, but no, it's fun.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm curious, just as a small aside, what did you think was too really wild in BDSM? And okay, scratch that. Not the question I want to ask. You said that things that you thought were really kinky and out there were actually quite common. Hmm. And then that it can be exciting. Did you learn first that it's pretty common and therefore the stuff, like you allowed yourself to be excited about things? Or did you learn about stuff that just wasn't as wild in BDSM? Like, did you learn about like things that you didn't know before that you found exciting?
Yeah. Yes. I think both things, no? So sometimes you read about things, or you talk to people about them.
Like spanking or...
Yeah. For example, you go to these meetings of sex-positive people, and they tell you, yes, about the spanking or about bondage or about role-play, and you imagine yourself doing that. Mm-hmm. When you imagine yourself doing this, you can have a positive or a negative reaction, in the sense that I wouldn't like that, or I would enjoy this a lot. When you try them, sometimes it's not, it doesn't coincide. So it's not the same. For example, in a swinging club, first time that I went to a swinging club, I went because I wanted to see how it was that. I wanted to talk to people, and I wanted to write about this in my book. But I didn't think I would end up doing anything, because having sex in public, again, for a conventional guy like me, it's not something that I thought I was going to enjoy. Once you're there, you are very shy at the first 30 minutes. After 30 minutes, you're with someone. It's like, well, maybe we should do something, not a lot. You start, and suddenly you end up doing more than what you expected.
It's love when the science person gets involved.
Well, I'm very scientific, because I was thinking, what's going on in my brain? Why is it the prefrontal cortex that it's inhibited, and that's what allows me to do this, or it's the view of this that excites me, and these mirror neurons maybe are... So I was very... Or the testosterone, or simply... I was analyzing it from the scientific point of view. In fact, one of the things that made me start this book is when I remember I was with a girl Saturday morning, and suddenly she had an orgasm and the pupils dilated.
Oh, you saw it?
I saw it suddenly. She had an orgasm, and she had blue eyes, I think she still has blue eyes. So the pupils at the orgasm dilated. I thought, why the pupils dilate? So I was thinking the physiologically basis, no? So I interviewed a physiologist, a scientist, who explained it to me. It's like, hey, when you have an orgasm, the sympathetic nervous system gets active. And a lot of things happen. So have you noticed that sometimes some women, when they have the orgasm, the nipples are very erect in that moment, or the chest, or the cheeks get a bit reddish? That's because the blood pressure, it's very high in the moment of orgasm. So there are small capillaries that break and give this redness. But also the pupils dilate because of the sympathetic nervous system. So I thought, now you can distinguish a fake orgasm.
Oh, interesting.
That's what I thought. Oh, if the pupils dilate during orgasm, that's a way to see.
Well, that's an easy one to foil. Just close your eyes, ladies.
Yeah, well, or at night. At night the pupils are dilated. But if the conditions allow you to distinguish, it's a funny story. But
it was wonderful.
But yeah.
Interesting. Oh my goodness. I appreciate you. I appreciate you so much for that. Oh, that's funny. Oh, what did you find in the chemical analysis of female ejaculation? I see that as one of the things that you explored. What did you find? Because I've had science people. And when I say science people, I mean they...
No, there are papers published about this, and there are two kinds of squirt, two kinds of female ejaculation. So the regular one that it's nearly all women have, but it's not easy to recognize, because sometimes it stays inside, or sometimes it's just very small. That's... has, for example, PSA, that's prostatic antigen. It's like semen without sperma, let's say. No? But then there is another kind of a squirt. It happens only to some people and only a few times. That's there are big quantities, and times, and this time is they see urea there mm-hmm. when they analyze. So it's mm-hmm. coming from the bladder. Mm-hmm. So it's urine, mm-hmm. Very diluted. And mm-hmm. there are some explanations. Vasopressin is when you are very excited, you have a lot of vasopressin, and you produce a lot of urine, and that's why many times after having sex you need to go to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, but sometimes, yes, there are these two kinds of female ejaculation. The regular one, the conventional one, that's nothing to do with urine.
Mm-hmm.
And another one that, yes, it is.
It's interesting. There is a sex educator and midwife. I don't remember what her other background is, but she wrote a book called Arousal and Female Pleasure, or Female Arousal and Anatomy. That's what it's uh-huh. called, named Sherry Winston. And she talks about that it's pulled from through tiny capillaries within the urethra, not the bladder. And I keep getting different answers as to female ejaculation and where it comes from. Of course, that's you're just talking about and analyzing the fluid.
No, but there's been done some capillaries also. There's mm-hmm. been there was a study where there was a capillary going to the bladder
mm-hmm.
and seeing if the liquid goes through the capillary or from outside the capillary.
Wait, I'm trying.
A capillary is a very thin
catheter.
Catheter.
We call it that
yeah,
catheter.
Sorry,
okay.
sorry.
No, it's
catheter.
Okay.
And with a woman that had these two kinds of of ejaculations, mm-hmm. and so there was a very strong. Also, the content of urea. Yeah. But again, I mean, it's nothing. Nobody has to be ashamed because liquid. And also, it's interesting because the other day I wrote a story about the G-spot.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because there's one this study recently saying that the G-spot doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And I said, of course it exists. Because there are other... And the vaginal orgasm also, there are different nerves that go to the vagina and that are different from the ones that go to the clitoris. And you can have an orgasm through stimulation of these nerves, the hypogastric nerves, instead of the pelvic and the pudendal. So it does exist, the vaginal orgasm. So I wrote this story, and there were some reaction of women saying, oh, because the study was done by men.
Uh-huh.
So men talking about female pleasure, female sex, what they know about. And I thought, hey, maybe more than you. In the sense that how many... In my book, I talk to some prostitutes to uh-huh. understand men's sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of experience. So some women... I always ask, how many orgasms, female orgasms, have you... Different from different people have you been into, no?
Mm-hmm.
Most of them, only one.
Okay.
Themselves. So I thought, no, I have... Apart from the science, because you, as a man, you have more... So in the sense that it was obvious for me that I had some couples that have very clear vaginal orgasms or have different kinds of ejaculations. And
but from prostitutes, you learn that they tended to only, their only experience with female pleasure was their own pleasure because they mainly slept with men? Or
no, maybe I haven't explained it. Well, I said I wanted to learn about male sexual behavior,
right.
and I talked to some prostitutes because they have been exposed.
Women's prostitutes, female
women,
prostitutes.
Yeah, female mm-hmm. prostitutes because they have exposed to many men. So what they do when you are with you? How long did it take them to have the orgasm? It's different aspects. In this sense, talking to men about female sexual pleasure is also useful because we have been present. It's not that I have this super long sexual life, but I've been with a few women. I saw differences between them. And probably that particular woman that's saying vaginal orgasm doesn't exist is because she doesn't feel it. She only feels the clitoral one.
Mm-hmm.
But I've met women, I've been with women that clearly has the mm-hmm. vaginal orgasm.
Why do you think they get angry about the idea of men? I mean, I totally agree. I've had men who are very doubtful of what I could possibly share or teach around male sexuality that could give them any light. Like, they've already figured it out that, like, I get how to masturbate. And then I start talking about different ways to handle yourself and how do some men handle themselves like this. And it's just even just hand grip and strength and how you can lean a penis in different directions. And suddenly these guys are... like, oh my God, you are telling me new things about my own penis. Like, I had no idea. And it's like, that's right, my friend. I may have paid more attention to penises than you.
Exactly. That's the point. That's the point. Yes, 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 yes. That's the right one that I was doing.
Yeah. So I hear you. I hear you. It's a hard answer. I believe you. I mean, well, no, of course I believe you and I believe analysis. I have a problem with all the scientists who are anti the idea that the G-spot exists. I mean, you know, because you wrote an article saying that they're being ridiculous for not being able to find it. Hmm. And when a scientist can't find it, they're like, the G-spot doesn't exist. You're like, yeah, it does.
It's a very interesting scientific search, no? Because it's true that they do surveys and they say, of course, that it must exist because there are some women that explain that 2 or 3 centimeters, and when you push upwards, you feel something special. But they do analysis like to see if there are more nerves, to see if there are more something different, and they don't see any anatomical structure. Then lately they have thought that could be the body of the clitoris, no? Mm-hmm. That when you are excited, it grows, and if you push, you can contact the bases of the erected clitoris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The G-spot.
Someday we'll have, it'll be official. Like, it'll be official, and that we'll know everything about female pleasure. Someday, everything. Or you have a look on your face like, we already did that.
No, well, so, I think it's quite clear that the G-spot is the connection, is connected to the clitoris.
Oh, I see. That you feel like it's pretty certain that the G-spot is basically is clit.
Huh.
Is because of the clit. Okay. I feel comfortable with that. Oh, well, what about... I mean, I'm fine with that answer. What about... sponges. The urethral sponge, the perineal sponge, the vestibular bulbs. Have you thought about those? Or like pressing on that erogenous tissue?
Is it so erogenous or not?
I don't know about how it's...
because one... Sorry to interrupt. But
no, okay.
One hypothesis about the G-spot is that this was the skin glands. That's a sponges tissue that is there.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't find more nerve endings there than in the rest of the... So...
Right, it's how is that... How is that erogenous tissue sponge? How is it innervated, right? Like, how are the nerve endings?
Let's say there are 2 basic efferent nerves that gives pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
The main one is the pudental nerve that goes directly to the clitoris, okay, or to the penis, to the external part of the penis. Then it's the pelvic nerve that gives. If you press, for example, in men. It's not the same if you only caress the penis or if you press it hard. Because if you press it hard, you activate the pelvic nerve. So it's a different sensation.
Oh, I didn't know that. I mean, I've heard about the pudendal being outside and the pelvic being more inside. But squeezing the shaft of the penis versus just touching the head,
yes.
Different nerves.
And if you touch the testicles, it's the hypogastric nerves.
Ooh.
I've been in an experiment. I've been doing this for an experiment, myself.
Well, you got, 27 years of science stuff?
No, I've been in a fMRI touching myself.
You got to be in the tube where they scan you and...
They were telling me now, Howard, shaft easy, glands easy for 5 times. Then shaft strong, glands strong. In theory, in the glands, there is only the pudendal nerve, the glands of the penis.
Okay.
But in the shaft, if you press it strong, there is the pelvic. And testicles easy is just, I don't know what's it, but if you press it strong, that's why you have this reaction with the men when you press the testicles hard. It's like, I don't like it. It's because the hypogastric nerve gets active. But the hypogastric nerve can give you pleasure also. Mm-hmm.
But the hypocastic?
Hypogastric.
Hypogastric nerve gets in the scrotum, gets... stimulated whether it's soft or hard.
I think only if it's hard.
Oh, okay. So soft, it's pudendal?
It will be some sense. Like, there are other nerves that you touch, like the groin or something. Mm-hmm. But and it's erosion, of course. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I know that when you do it hard, the hypogastric gets active. No.
All right. Hard on the testicles. You got that. We got a little pudendal at the head of the glands. We've got a hard squeeze on the shaft, and we'll get the pelvic. And pelvic is also a prostate.
The prostate is, I think it's the hypogastric also.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Or the vagus.
Oh, the vagus.
The vagus is an interesting nerve, but it doesn't go through the spinal cord.
It doesn't?
No, it's a nerve that goes when you have some stomach or intestines or something. It's the nerve that goes through the vagus. And that's the big discovery of Barry Komisaruk, who was doing the brain scan with him. He had some women with a spinal cord injury. Mm-hmm. So there was no nerve reaching the vagina or the clitoris, but with deep stimulation they felt pleasure through the vagus nerve.
What? Okay, what's his name?
Barry Komisaruk.
Now I know that do you still work at MIT?
Part-time, yeah.
Okay, part-time. And Harvard, is he over in that area?
He's in Rutgers University, New York.
Oh, okay. Oh, of course, because
he's been in the media a lot. It's because he's the man who's putting the people under the fMRI, especially women, masturbating in the clitoris or inside. So he was doing some experiments with people with spinal cord injury to identify these nerves, to see how if they give pleasure or not. And suddenly he discovered, like, 7 or 8 years ago, that the women had, or with men with a spinal cord injury, a few of them had even orgasms through deep stimulation.
That's
and probably
wonderful.
Was the vagus. And he wants to study, because I know him very well, he wants to study now men with spinal cord injury to see if the prostate is through the vagus nerve or something different, because gay people with spinal cord injury, some of them, they still feel pleasure, not in the genitals, but in the anus.
Interesting.
Dun, dun.
This is wonderful.
Science is amazing, because scientists, by definition, does research on the things that you don't know, that nobody knows.
Right, and sometimes on this show, when it comes to people who teach a lot around sexuality, who do research, we'll go over the same information over and over again. So it's fun in each interview when I can be like, I haven't heard this yet. Tell me. I mean, like, you don't even know how many times we've talked about parasympathetic nervous system. I'm like, but I have not heard about that.
So, about parasympathetic? You haven't heard?
No. I mean, I've heard about that many times. Okay, I want to switch gears for a second, maybe for the rest of this episode. Like, hang on tight, because we're about to go somewhere else, which is, I don't know a lot about the Spanish-speaking world. I mean, I've been to Peru, I've been to Mexico, I've never been to Spain. But from what I've heard, there is a extreme need for more sex education.
Yes.
And sex conversation in different cultures. Now, it seems weird to lump all the Spanish-speaking world together culturally. That wouldn't make sense, really.
No, because it's also for social classes, no?
Oh, okay.
It's very diverse. In fact, when you check statistics, also about differences between men and women. Men are like this, men are from Mars and Venus. Women are from... No, it doesn't make sense. There's so much diversity within the groups, the generalizing. But it's true. I remember, this is a fun anecdote. I was in the International Society of Sexual Medicine conference in Chicago, 2012. It's all about medicine and sexuality, hormones, treatments. And there was this Venezuelan sexologist that told me, these gringos, they know a lot about sexuality and they don't know anything about sensuality.
Ooh.
And it's true. But when you go to these Latin American countries, you see that they know a lot about sensuality, but they know nothing about sexuality. They have this basic question. They are very sensual and they like sex a lot, but they haven't had education. They haven't had... They don't even... So they have sex. They are not ashamed to have sex, but they don't talk about them, especially women.
Huh.
I've met women that tell me, hey, I don't know if I ever had an orgasm. I think you would know that, no? But no, it's true that Latin America is very interesting, and not all countries are the same, no? You go to Chile, for example, is more conservative, no? And Argentina, they pretend to be more European than Latin American.
Good to know.
But then you go to the tropics, it's mm-hmm. totally different. And Mexico is very, there's a lot of machism in Mexico. Mm-hmm. So, but again, it's on average, but there are a lot of diversity within the countries.
Okay. All right. So I don't even know how to, okay. Have you noticed, I mean, beside the sensuality versus sexuality thing, because in America, even though you've hung out with a lot of sex positive educators and scientists here in the States, culturally, we're still pretty uptight around sensuality and sexuality.
Yes.
So it's not like a total reverse, I would think, despite what your Venezuelan colleague might say. So do you feel like no matter what the language, Spanish or English, everyone pretty much has the same needs? Like if you're writing for a Latin American country, like a periodical that's going to, like, you write it to in Spanish speaking periodicals, are you going to write about sex any differently than an English speaking?
Maybe, but maybe not because of the people, also because of the information that they are exposed. Mm-hmm. I know that if I don't write to English for obvious reasons to English people, but
you generally do not write in English.
Nah, just small things. But if I was supposed to write in English, I would be more sophisticated in the sense that I know that there are more information here.
Oh, okay.
Than in the Spanish-speaking world. So I need to be more basic in some, not in Spain, but maybe not in Mexico, but in other places, no?
All right.
The questions that I've been asked when I'm traveling, I was in Mexico last week, I've been in Colombia this year, mm-hmm. and I've traveled to many places, the questions are very, very basic.
Okay.
And it reflects that they don't have good information. So that would be a difference. But, for example, we check statistics. What you were saying, it's true. Everybody has the same similar needs.
Okay.
There are differences with Asia. In people with the Southeast Asia, the female sexual pleasure is complicated there. So the levels of anorgasmia.
Okay. In terms of the statistics, you're seeing that it's much
more
difficult.
You see, for example, it's not so different from. So the origin is not what defines the differences. If you're coming from Mexico or you're coming from. Are other, so social class, health status, there are many other differences, or religion, for example, plays a bigger role than other things.
So religion plays a bigger role than other things.
Yes.
It's the Catholics.
Ah, yeah.
Oh, my goodness, the sound you just made. Yeah. This has actually been a really wonderful interview so far. Oh, so can I find out more about what the sensuality in the Spanish-speaking world is about? I mean, since our listeners are primarily America, Canada, UK. When I say America, I feel bad because the Americas are the entire continents, but like the United States. Does that annoy you?
No, not me.
Oh, okay. Not you, but other people.
But I know the people that do. It's the way they look at you.
The way they look at you? Like on the street?
No, not in the street, but the flirting is more present, I think. And it's not flirting that wants... I was in Colombia recently. In maybe not all the countries is the same. But you feel the sensuality, the way they move, the way they touch. Here in the U.S., people don't touch themselves so much. And when I say touch
themselves. Like
it's not even when you hug someone, it's
like a little pat.
Yeah,
no big deal.
Like, you hug like this is not a real hug. When you hug someone in Spain or Latin America, it's more, and it doesn't necessarily be sensual, but it's sensual. But at night with the dance, with the constant flirting, I think it's a difference. Yeah.
Okay, what is flirting to you?
Flirting is it's to behave like if you are attracted to that person and you would like to connect physically. So you're giving signs mm-hmm. that you are interested, No? Okay. Like animals flirt in the sense of the giving odors or showing or dancing or mm-hmm. something. No? So humans flirt, it's showing interest. Very obvious to that person.
So if people, and when you say, I mean, I'm just saying the Spanish speaking world, but are we talking Latin America or just sort of Latin America and South America? More Latin. Are you also speaking to Spain?
No, not Spain is a bit different.
That's own thing going on.
Yeah, we are not so different, but it's, yeah, it's, it would say that, for example, Catalonia, where I'm from, is more European, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know.
Are they flirtatious?
No, Catalans, no.
No.
Catalans are very boring.
How about New Yorkers, where you currently live? How are they?
Oh, New York is crazy. New York is... You don't need to flirt to have sex.
Oh, what? Really? Then what do you do? You just get on Tinder? What?
Or you just, I had never happened to me before in Spain or in other places, that you are simply in a bar and there's this girl that comes to you and so it starts a conversation, but it's very obvious that she wants something and it's like, oh, wow, this is very direct, no? Where's the flirting? Where's the
Wait, okay,
sensuality?
So that's confusing because maybe me being an American, I have a hard time with what flirting is. Like, I don't know when I'm doing it. Or I might lean in, you know, maybe like cock my head to one side and smile a little bit, but I also just feel like a total cheese ball when I do that. So she's coming over to you.
Huh.
She's showing interest.
Yeah.
And yet that doesn't seem like flirting to you. Is it like a robot? Like she's
nope. So this,
I want to touch you.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Maybe it's that the signs are so obvious that was not a subtle flirting. Of course, it could be defined as flirting also. But not a sensual flirting, let's say.
Like she wants to like pet your face? Like, is that sensual? If I just say...
No, I don't know. Maybe now I'm thinking a couple of situations where... So normally... It's the man that goes to the girl and is like, hey, what are you doing? Do you want a drink or something? Different men have different... Mm-hmm. It has never happened to me the contrary. Or that it's that the girl shows clearly...
that she's she wants to have sex.
Yes.
Oh, so is it more just men hitting on versus women hitting on? Or is it the way the women and men are...
Yes. O sea, in Latin America, for example, the girl will look at you, will dance, but won't come to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's the man who has mm-hmm. to go to the mm-hmm. woman. I'm not defending that.
Oh, definitely.
But in New York, what has happened to me is that some girls approached me.
Okay.
In a clear, obvious searching for hookup mm-hmm. or something. I was like, wow, that's weird.
Oh, okay. So that's weird. That's weird for you. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely an interesting time in our culture.
Oh, that's perfect. I can't complain. I can't complain. I like that.
But if you're, let's say, you're in Chile, or no, because they act European. Let's say you're in, I don't know, Ecuador. I'm trying to just pull one out,
example.
And you want to approach a woman and kind of do the sensual flirting thing, and you know, because you're interested. Versus, you're in New York and want to do the sensual first flirting thing. Do you have to change your behavior depending on a woman in which culture?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are some cultural rules about flirting. And I remember I was talking about this in Mexico the other day
mm-hmm.
with a group of women that were neuroscientists, that we were talking about this neuroscience and sexuality, and said, no, we like men. It's coming to us.
Mm-hmm.
We are not going to, even if they want to have something with that guy, they're not going to be obvious. They're not going to be easy
mm-hmm.
because of the culture. Mm-hmm. And probably in some parts of the U.S. is similar, but in New York, I don't think there is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a bit different. Or maybe the big cities.
Oh, well, I mean, there is the question of who approaches. Is it men, women? Will men be too thrown off if women approach. There's always that question.
Not to me.
Not to you.
And in general, I mean, if you are insecure, if you're a man that's a bit insecure, maybe, or you're very conservative, maybe you have this reaction, but I don't think... Nah, you can approach us, yeah.
So I'm in a bar in Argentina. Oh, wait, no, that's not even Spanish-speaking. That's Portuguese.
No, Argentina is Spanish-speaking.
Yes. Oh, Brazil is where it's Portuguese. Yes. That's right. Okay, so I'm in Argentina. It's a tango club, my favorite.
You'll be surrounded. In Argentina, you'll be surrounded by men.
Oh, it's just, that's just, okay, okay.
So, it's a bad example, but let's say...
Name a country.
Huh?
Name a country.
A country that they've been, for
very
example...
Central.
Yes, let's say Colombia, for example.
Okay,
no?
Colombia. I'm in a bar in Colombia, and I'm interested in a man across the way. How do I flirt and behave sensually in a non-American way?
You just look at him.
It's just, that's it.
If he sees that you are looking at him, he will take you to dance.
Okay, so...
If she likes you, and I think she would...
Oh, thank
but,
you.
But no, if you look at him, you are showing interest. You're somehow asking him to come. This is the code there. No?
I'm going to give you three different looks, and you're going to tell me which one's going to work the best, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. One would be the glance and look down, right? It was just a moment. I just looked at you for a moment. Mm. Two would be like... like just straight up in your face, kind of like almost angry at you a little bit, but then look away. Or, I can't even do this one. Like the...
Yeah, this third one.
Okay,
course.
Third one. So
you just smile, look at smile. Don't pretend to be sophisticated or something.
So slightly scared.
Huh?
Prolonged eye contact and slightly scared or soft looking.
Yes, I'm looking and smile. And if you smile, that would be very obvious.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's not too forward to smile.
But yeah.
It's difficult. We overanalyze this here on the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast. Oh, this is fun. Thank you for giving me all these little tips. Oh, that's really...
It's nothing scientifically proof, but...
Well, but also just your experience of maneuvering through so many different countries, the cross-cultural perspective is valuable.
It's absolutely, yeah. It's very interesting, I think.
Yeah. Oh, I want to end with this, and because this is something that is important to me. Primarily, you've been working in the science field.
Huh.
Research. Communicating, journalism, writing, producing, on camera, behind the camera, all these ways, which is fantastic. And then you step into the sexuality realm and you look at science and you put it into a book. And I wouldn't call you necessarily a sex educator, but you are educating people about sex. I mean, you talk about how you get these questions from people, these basic questions.
Yeah, but they don't answer.
You don't answer?
No, because I don't want to be a sex educator. I inform. I give information. But I'm not a sexologist, and I don't want to play the role of a sex educator.
Mm-hmm.
So I know all the answers. And of course, when I'm doing a show with people, they ask me things and I answer. But it's not that I'm presenting myself as an expert or as an educator. So I just give information in the sense that I'm giving information about the cosmology or neuroscience or climate change. I'm giving information about nutrition, sports, and also sexology, sexuality.
How would you define the difference between education and information?
But probably it's so it's a topic. So I don't tell young people you have to use condoms.
Okay.
It's It's not, of course they have to, but it's not the content of my information. Or I'm not telling couples, look, try this, because it's every couple is different. So I'm just giving general information that's very useful. People that are reading my book is like, wow, I've learning a lot. I'm learning different things.
Mm-hmm.
So especially the ones that like sex, that knows about sex, they enjoy a lot my book because it's a different view.
Mm-hmm.
But education, it's very biased also. So in my country, where Catholicism is, so they can't.
I see what you're saying.
Some education is like, oh, don't have sex. I'm not telling anyone what to do or what not to do.
It's almost like some scientific papers, there'll be the research and the findings. And sometimes there's a problem between the findings and then the conclusions that they'll jump to. And especially, and even if that is not biased, then a journalist might, or educators or religious people, they'll take a piece of research and then take it and apply it to what their
views about
their views and what their agenda is. And they'll make it about, be like, oh, if this is true, then you should definitely be like this. They definitely jump to a behavioral conclusion from the information. I don't even know if I'm really expressing that correctly.
No, yeah. Take, for example, the HPV and the oral sex, the cancer. If you can have oral cancer through, so I give you the statistics.
Okay.
I'm not going to tell you this is dangerous or not.
Okay.
You decide if this amount of risk is dangerous or not. For me, it's not very dangerous. But for other people, can use it as a, oh, don't do that because it's... Also, if you go to schools talking about sex, you are educating. I'm not going to schools talking about sex. I'm not pretending to do that.
Okay. Oh, my goodness. No, I appreciate your views on that. And it's also... Because I'm always trying to check myself in terms of the ethics of what I do, which I don't think there's enough conversation around ethics in the sexuality field. And I'm sure from the scientific perspective, you've probably noticed some issues.
No, take, for example, the cheating situation. I'm not going to say, going to give you information about the your biology, about the statistics, but I'm not going to judge if cheating is something awful or it's something that nothing, it's not so bad. Or so I can give you the different, I can inform you about the polyamory situation, about the swinging people, about different cultures, because there are some sociologists that that do research on this, and also biologists or psychologists. It's very multidisciplinary field, no? But I don't have an agenda. I have my own views, but I'm not trying to impose them to others.
Oh, that's a good reminder for me. Do you think that sex research... I interviewed a gentleman named Corey Silverberg. You may know him. He lives in New York as well. He just wrote the book, What Makes a Baby? It's a children's book with no gender. He's a marvelous sex educator. He's the main writer for About.com's sexuality section. And... he has a problem with sex research because it's skewed in every direction and you can twist it to anything. And he's sort of over sex research. He's just like, it's fun, it's interesting, but nothing's going to tell you more about yourself than you.
No, that's stupid. No, that's not, no. Of course, research in general, not only in sexuality, in general, gives you a lot of information about you and about others. Of course, it won't tell you how you feel.
Okay.
You will need to feel it yourself. Mm-hmm. That's obvious. And you'll... research is not going to tell you why you like sadomasochism instead of tantra.
Okay.
But gives you a lot of information. It's the tool that we have to discover how the world or how our bodies or how our brain works. Mm-hmm. Without research, we would look at the sky and would see stars, only stars, firing, all white and all static. Now, thanks to research, we know that they are moving, that there are black holes, that they are quasars, that they are exoplanets, and also about how your brain works. So asexuality, sexual orientation, people that are different.
Yeah,
it's a very interesting tool to understand why they are different, how the body works. Of course, it's not to make them feel bad about or call them. No. But for example, when science explains what happens in an asexual person, it's normalizing that. They feel that they are not behaving that they are supposed to behave. But like, no, you are supposed to behave exactly like this because you have these hormones or you have this brain structure or something, and you're part of the diversity of the human condition. And I always say, people that say that homosexuality is weird because people don't get... No, no. Homosexuality is normal. It needs to be homosexual from a biological point of view because reproduction is very basic. So what natural selection does is to create many different kinds of individuals, and some of them reproduce, but it's constantly creating diversity. So diversity is normal.
So and essential, really, to survival.
For the survival of the species, diversity is essential, is fundamental. So in this diversity, it's normal that there are homosexuals, that there are asexual, there are different sexual orientations. So the nature tells you that difference in sexual orientations are normal. But research is telling you. I understand what this guy is trying to say, but it works when you're a therapist.
Okay.
Because you have this individual person, an individual couple, and science doesn't give you a lot of information.
Right. Informing on an individual.
Yeah.
But population-wide, it's so important.
And also, for that individual, maybe, if you have a woman with anorgasmia, how you know if it's a physiological or is a psychological issue? There are some women that doesn't reach orgasm because of they have psychological blockages or they have had bad experiences. Mm-hmm. Others have problems with the nerves or problems with the hormones. Mm-hmm. So you need this to understand how the body works. And there's a lot of women that have been in the psychological therapy for ages.
And they should have gotten...
Look, in the book, I explain the story of a urologist from Argentina who was the president of the International Society of Sexual Medicine. Mm-hmm. He said, I remember many years ago when I first tried with a patient Viagra.
Okay.
I remember the sentence that patient gave me. She said, "Doctor, how is that possible after 6 years of psychotherapy? You solve everything with a pill."
Oh, no.
So that guy didn't have a psychological problem. Mm-hmm. It has a physiological one.
It was a man?
It was a man, the Viagra. I think research is giving you a lot of information and it's improving the work of therapists, the ones that incorporate it.
Okay. Thank you. Like that was a long answer, wonderful. Yeah. No, that was wonderful. And I love the passion that came out. I was like, yeah.
Oh, science for me is my passion. Sex also, but science is my real passion.
Oh, right. For me, the thought of someone going through psychological counseling for 6 years and never getting a medical evaluation first, just to double check that everything was functioning on a medical level, like that's so concerning to me.
There's been many things that they were thought it was psychological. Mm-hmm. Problems and not physiological. Mm-hmm. But that guy has some problems with the oxynitrox NO levels in there. The oxynitrox, nitroso, I don't know how you say it.
No, nitrous oxide? No, that doesn't sound right. I know what you mean, though. Yes.
The compound that helps to vasodilate the arteries of the penis and get an erection.
Okay.
The blood flows. Going there.
Petty, where can people find you out in the world? Like Twitter or your website?
Yes. My name is not so common, even in Spanish, so it's very easy to look for Pérez Estupiñá. Nobody was going to get it. But I'm in Twitter and Facebook. Twitter, okay. Like Pérez Estupiñá and Facebook also. And maybe it's easier if you write S equal EX square.
Okay.
I have the title of the book, so it will refer to my book and my name and everything.
All right.
You can contact me and send me an email if you want.
What's your email?
pere@mit.edu. Very easy also.
That's a fancy email address.
It's very cool having an email called pere@mit.edu. That's cool, yeah.
And just, I mean, PEREESTUPINYA?
Yes.
Oh, I got it. Boom. High five. All right. Thank you so much for sitting with me and talking about all this wonderful stuff.
Thank you. No, it's been a pleasure. very exciting.
And as we say here on the show, go team fun.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.